Sirocco, written by Andrew Wood and Alastair Morton. Read by Jeff Harding. The icy Atlantic wind swept across the concourse of Boston's North Station, sending people huddling into corners in the vain attempt to keep warm. Families and couples, braving the chill that had brought most of Massachusetts to a standstill, shuddered from shops and vendors to platforms and trains. The weekend commuters carried on as if the temperature and calendar were only a concern for mere mortals, and not one which concerned individuals of their stature and importance. In the main hall, weather-weary travelers congregated under the departures board, hoping to find their refuge and escape from the elements. Amtrak Northeast Corridor trains to New York and Washington, D.C., and Midwest-bound trains to Chicago mixed with the luring appeal of destinations like Miami and Atlanta and the promise of warmer climes. But they had little effect, as the sub-zero temperature of the northeastern seaboard's cruel winters banished away any such momentary indulgences. The harsh realities of the immediate vicinity were inescapable. As time appeared to stand still, 200 miles south, down the coast, the sun shone brightly across a driving range in upstate New York. It was crowded with golfers, with not so much as a single bay free. Along the far end of the range, dressed discreetly in black pants, charcoal gray polo neck sweater, and a dark sun visor, stood a lone woman. Carefully and with precision, and displaying a force that vastly outmatched her male counterparts, she repeatedly hit a myriad of balls straight and fast across the range, all coming to rest within mere yards of one another. Stopping to survey her angle of trajectory, she glanced at her watch, molding the two actions into one, so it was to appear unnoticeable to any surveying eyes. But there were none. The range's 50-plus other inhabitants, most of whom were male and oblivious to the gendered other within their midst, were engrossed in their own conversations and tales of business success and social climbing. Who had sold what and closed what deal? Who was getting away with extracurricular dalliances in the city? Meanwhile, as the stranger eyed her watch, the hands on the Boston station clock ticked by, seemingly slowing down as if they were unwilling to keep going. They moved around the numbered face, and for all the world they appeared to be aware that something was going to happen, and they sorely wished they were no longer a part of it. As the hands continued around the clock face to strike 9:30, their fate and destination sealed, the station was overcome suddenly with a wave of silence. A single second where conversation and commotion ceased blanketing the focused existence within the station and cutting it off from the outside. At that point, as the mysterious stranger teed up another ball and hit it firmly to the outer edge of the driving range, the explosive she had planted the day before in the Massachusetts transportation hub detonated. The walls of the 100-year-old station shook under a force that they could not withstand, and sections of the roof buckled and collapsed. Huge portions of concrete and glass plummeted down on the helpless individuals beneath as the bomb tore through the main hall, obliterating everything within its reach and rupturing the concourse floor. The power of the blast shredded one of the main supporting walls of the upper floor, sending it crashing down onto the main concourse and collapsing onto the Green Line underground track below that. Nobody in the station stood a chance, and everyone inside the main hall was killed instantly. The hall itself and the entrance to the station, reduced to rubble and wreckage, had become an inhospitable place where it seemed no life could have survived. The ticket office, the newsstands, the coffee shops and bars, all fused with the rush and bustle of everyday life minutes earlier, were gone, replaced by a gaping hole filled by nothing except the dust and debris-strewn air in which they once stood. The shaking and deafening roar of the explosions subsided. only to be replaced with a louder, more guttural and piercing sound of hundreds of people's screams. The air became impenetrable, and sight restricted to a few yards in front of the face. But amongst all the chaos and mayhem, the smell of blood and of suffering was evident, and all too palpable. The people fortunate enough to be outside of the bomb blasts, on the Orange Line elevated platforms, or in the cramped waiting areas over the South End tracks, or outside the station on Causeway and Nashua Street, escaped with their lives. But only just. The force of the blast claimed the lives of those inside the station, but took something more valuable from those who survived. A piece of who they were before was also killed in the explosion, and something that could not be replaced. A sense of calm and peace had been stolen from them, never to be returned. When the shock and bewilderment had gone, panic began to set in as the injured struggled from the wreckage, trying to ply fellow victims from the masonry. The emergency services swarmed the front of the building, cordoning it off and moving around with great speed. But the unexpectedness of the attack meant they were unprepared and ill-equipped to handle a situation of this scale. As rescue crews battled to save people still inside the former station, FBI men in suits and overcoats prowled the perimeter, trying to fathom the reason and cause. While TV crews and reporters hassled anyone in sight for information to broadcast to the viewing world. More than 170 dead in a suspected terrorist attack on the city of Boston, many more seriously wounded, was pumped around the world within minutes of the act itself. 12 die in bus outside the city's North Station as a result of the explosion. 38 die on a subway train as part of the station concourse collapses. The details flowed with a strange detachment from the pain and violence that had occurred in reality, and the events passed from the city streets of downtown Boston into the global hyperreal, to be digested by the viewing millions, amongst whom was the perpetrator of the crime itself. Thousands of miles away, in the comfort and safety of Montreux, Switzerland, the terrorist responsible for the attack viewed the effects of his work on CNN. As the dead and injured were carried out of the station, the fallout was analyzed, and the international condemnations began. The terrorist was Colonel Haji Hassan Suleiman, the former head of Saddam Hussein's intelligence service, and a man with a pathological hatred of America. The colonel had long been a wanted war criminal and the target of several assassination attempts, the last of which appeared to have been successful. A body had been found, riddled with bullets, wearing Suleiman's uniform, and had been buried in Baghdad with full military honors. But it was a fake. They'd used a look-alike. "Well done, Sabina," said Suleiman, as he watched with pleasure on TV the coverage of the attack by his female operative, who had planted the bomb that would rock the U.S. government and destroy the security the U.S. public had grown accustomed to. Suleiman's voice was indicative of his command of the room and demonstrated his control over the proceedings.
"Contact Baghdad. Tell them Sirocco Phase 1 successful. Target 1 taken out. Phase 2 in 36 hours.
"Yes, Colonel,"
came the reply from one of his men, who left the room to follow his instructions, carrying a purpose and efficiency that bordered on fanatical rather than merely subordinate. As he left, Colonel Haji Hassan Suleiman turned his attention back to the television screen, absorbing the devastation and chaos he had wreaked with a sense of satisfaction, confident and reassured by the knowledge that this was merely the start, that this was just the first action in a series of attacks that would take the United States by surprise and which would bring the president to his knees. In a small house in Annandale, within the confines of Fairfax County and set deep in a suburban environment of peace and comfort, a man sat at his kitchen table in front of a collection of old and antique clocks. Some were in pieces, arranged neatly across the surface of the table, while others were standing up, partially assembled. Beside the man sat a small toolbox and a cloth, as he went about restoring them. The kitchen was tidy and organized, everything in its correct position, and it looked like any other kitchen. The kettle and toaster sat next to each other, occupying adjacent spaces. The sink was clean and dry, and the work surfaces immaculate, except for a mug. And on the window ledge sat a healthy chrysanthemum. The only item, seemingly at odds with the suburban milieu, was a red phone hanging on the wall, right next to the more recognizable and expected cordless one. Staring through this window at the garden and street beyond, leaves and color still lining the street in late November, was Jack Wildy, the head of the U.S. Secret Intelligence Service at Langley. He was a tall man with broad shoulders and rough features, unfairly accentuating his middle-aged years, which was underpinned by a frame that barely disguised the body of a man of strength. He was a fast burner and had risen through the CIA quickly after leaving the Marines at the age of 25, already having gone from a young lieutenant to major in his 6 years in the military. Having developed a straight-ahead, no-nonsense approach, finely tuned through years spent in the field, he possessed the determination and resolve of a natural leader and the patience of a monk, combined with a shrewdness that only experience brings. The peaceful bedroom community of Annandale, marked by its wealthy inhabitants, sleepy farmhouses, and whose history was intimately connected with the settlement of the U.S., was a picture postcard of family values and the American way. Its small-town atmosphere and sense of isolation, despite its proximity to major East Coast centers, seemed an unusual retreat for the government man. But it had one particular thing going for it, one individual special quality meant it was the center of the world for him. It was his home, and where he felt he belonged. As Jack sat at the table, contemplating his clocks, the red phone on the wall began to ring. Jack grabbed it and said commandingly, "Wildy!" "Hey, Jack, it's me, Roy. Have you heard about Boston?" Roy Wise was the head of the CIA and a contemporary of Jack's who knew him from the beginning, from their early years, and their paths had crossed on numerous assignments. "Boston? No. Why? I haven't had the TV on. What's happened?" "Turn on your TV and you'll see what I'm talking about," said Wise. Standing in the doorway between the kitchen and the hallway, and looking down the hall towards the front door, as if expecting someone to walk through, the peace and privacy he'd been permitted seconds earlier rapidly dissipated as Roy relayed the news of the bombing attack to him. Still holding the phone, and without losing the expression of concentration he seemed to carry around permanently, he turned and switched the television on. Sitting on a shelf high up in the corner of the kitchen like a judge presiding over a court, the TV flickered into life, filling the room with sound first, and then picture a few seconds later. The noise of sirens and muffled voices filled the room as a nameless newsreader described the scene. Jack's mind conjured horrific images which were haunted by the horrors he'd seen in the war in Vietnam. But the images his mind had thrust upon him, unforgivably saturating his conscious stream of thought, could not prepare him for what he was to see. Scenes of people running and screaming down dust-filled city streets immediately brought recollections of September 11. That fateful day that had seemed so unrealistic back then, as if watching something from the movies, had come to haunt the everyday normality, and the images themselves had soaked into the very fabric of modern life. The very condition of the world had become shaped in some form or another by the events that unfurled in New York. And looking at the TV screen, it was impossible for Jack to differentiate the images he was seeing from those of 6 years previous. After watching them for a minute, Jack changed the channel, but it was the same, each TV station broadcasting its own reports of the attack. "Jack?" Roy's voice was stern but seemingly humbled. "Are you there?" "Yeah," he replied. "How many people are dead?" "We don't know yet, but you'd better get up there. This is going to have to be done swiftly and properly. We need to get this one right." "I'm on it," Jack replied. He replaced the receiver, put the tools quietly back into the toolbox, and covered the clocks with a cloth. He then grabbed his coat from the back of the chair and left through the kitchen door. The world was a very different place to how it was on September 10th, 2001. Or at least America's place within the world was very different. The invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan had provoked protest within the U.S. as well as abroad, and the world had become an increasingly divided place. Tormented by fear and paranoia, the bombing in Boston would be more closely scrutinized by the eyes of the world, and Jack knew it. The actions of the United States examined by everyone with a microphone, and judged by them and almost everyone else. American citizens' faith in their country was already at an all-time low, and America's position as the single global hyperpower had been threatened again for the entire world to see. Actions needed to be taken, and those responsible brought to justice. No unaccounted-for bin Ladens this time. But it had to be done right, or else the repercussions could be even worse. In an eruption of violence, the once sleepy northeast college town had suddenly become the focus of the world, the events of the future shaped by what would follow. But one thing was certain. The fallout would be globally consuming and would drag the world further into a state of fear and uncertainty from which it would be harder and harder to return. When Jack arrived in Boston, the city seemed stunned by the attack that had befallen it, and the sky itself seemed to be in pain as rain poured relentlessly on the cityscape beneath it. People were still dumbstruck by the unprovoked attack that their city and country had been subjected to. Jack arrived on the scene, having traveled straight to North Station from General Edward Lawrence Logan Airport, and witnessed the destruction for himself. Pushing his way through the crowds of people and walking directly up to the FBI agents already on the scene, he took in the wreckage and devastation that lay before him while trying to piece together a picture of what had occurred. "Holy shit, what a fucking mess. Just how bad is it?" Jack asked one of the local FBI agents who'd already assessed the scene, although the magnitude of the damage seemed to be too much for him to cope with, and there was only a limited amount he could usefully reply.
"It's the worst I've seen since the Marine barracks in Beirut," boomed a voice just behind Jack, and he turned to see FBI agent Ellis Carter. "It's 9/11 all over again. Over 160 dead, double that wounded, and we're still finding others. Part of the concourse collapsed onto the train and the subway, so God knows how many are dead down there. We're still digging them out." Agent Carter was a familiar face to Jack, and a welcome one at that. Jack had known him from years earlier, when the then-young agent had been tracking a suspect on a case that brought him to D.C. Ellis was a rookie back then, but Jack noticed a determination in him, one which reminded him of himself a little, and the two had remained in contact since.
"Ellis, how are you?" Jack inquired, glad to see his old friend. But the wreckage that lay before them prevented the pair from reacquainting themselves more.
"How did it happen? Any ideas where the bomb was located?" Jack asked, knowing that it was too early for any prognosis to have been reached. But he'd already begun going through scenarios of his own, his experience giving him an unbridled insight into how an operation of this scale would have had to be carried out.
"No one's claimed responsibility yet. It's early days, but we believe it stems from the Middle East. They use Semtex."
"Are you sure?" Jack asked.
"Not sure yet, but I'd bet my pension on it. You used to be in the Special Forces, Jack. You know the smell, the scent of almond in the air. I could smell it the moment I got here."
Jack had picked up on this, but he was wary of jumping to conclusions, knowing that if everything points to one thing, it is usually too good to be true. In his experience, at least.
"It could be," Jack offered noncommittally, still assessing the scene himself. Until the site was cleared and inspected properly, there would be no way of knowing where the blast originated. But it had to be somewhere where a package could be left and no one would ask any questions. It was 6 hours after the explosion had taken place,
and there were still fires being put out. But the site was secure, and Wildy and Agent Carter, with a team of agents, made their way inside the station and onto what was left of the concourse. Inside, the shell of the station remained intact, but it was damaged beyond recognition. The outer walls and structure stood firm, but the internal structures and buildings were gone. The crater onto the subway had been reinforced, and emergency crews were working down below through the rubble looking for survivors. And although people could still be alive, as every minute passed, it became more an exercise in retrieving bodies. And all the rescue teams knew it. It just remained unsaid, in the hope that the unbelievable could become the possible. Examining the direction of the blast, the location of the bomb was immediately apparent, although the precise place could not be known, as there was not enough left of the station for this to be visible.
"We're going to need the structural plans of the station, all levels, inside and out," Jack barked, giving his first order since arriving on the scene. He'd not taken charge yet. Instead, he'd examined everything and decided upon a course of action. It was more than just likely that those responsible came from the Middle East. But there was nothing to be gained by proffering this type of assumption without the evidence to back it up.
"It's my guess the bomb was left on one of the storage lockers in the concourse," said Carter, momentarily losing his footing in the rubble. "It's the only place it could be left without raising the alarm. The motherfuckers intended to kill a lot of people, Jack."
Before he could respond, his cell phone rang, and Jack made his way back to the station entrance and outside, where he could remove his handkerchief from covering his mouth and answer the call. Barely able to hear amidst all the noise and turmoil, he could nevertheless recognize the familiar voice on the other end of the line. It was a voice he could trust, and one he knew he could count on. The voice of Don Coyne, communications chief of the CIA, based at Langley.
"Jack, Don here. I hear you're right in the middle of all this."
"Yeah, Don, it's a bad one. Bad as it gets. Someone intended to send a real clear message up here."
"Well, that's why I'm calling, Jack. One of my guys intercepted a radio signal out of Baghdad earlier on today. He took no notice of it at first, just logged it as every other scrambled message. I think you should hear it, though."
"Go ahead. What does it say?"
Jack had already begun to form his own ideas about who could be responsible. His experience had taught him that it wasn't just what had happened that was important, but to understand the message being carried. And that was where he focused his thoughts.
"Sirocco Phase 1 successful, Target 1 taken out, Phase 2 in 36 hours. "That's it, Jack. It doesn't mean anything to us, other than maybe Boston, of course."
The phone went silent as Jack absorbed the information. But more than surprise, it was just slotting into what he had already suspected. What he had already feared. If the message was related, and it seemed that there was no possible way that it could not be, it meant that Boston was not an isolated incident. There could be more attacks.
"It's got to be involved." Don thought the same, and the tone of his voice confirmed this to Jack,
subdued and overwhelmed in a manner that was unusual for him. As communications chief, he was a larger-than-life character who possessed a booming voice that commanded attention whenever he walked in a room. He was an eternal optimist and a pessimist job, intercepting global communications and deciphering what they meant and who they were intended for, relaying what would often be uncomfortable news, or at the best unwanted news, to people on a daily basis. But this time, his voice carried a resignation that caught Jack by surprise. The resilience gone as if it had been beaten out of him. Something that was there, but that had been worn down until it could no longer survive, and it just gave up hope.
"Okay, listen, Don."
Trying to bring back the assertiveness he'd relied on from his old friend so many times in the past.
"I need you to get in contact with all my SIS agents in the field. Get them to check and report back on all known terrorists, particularly the Middle East, Iraq, and Afghanistan, okay, Don?"
His beleaguered colleague took the orders and set them into motion, jarring himself from his wearied submission. Right, Jack. I need to know if anyone isn't where they're supposed to be, Don. As soon as possible. And I want to know as much as you can turn up on this signal in Sirocco, okay? I'll be in Langley in 3 hours. I'll see you then.
Wildy snapped his cell phone closed and immediately turned his attention back to the station, as if he was jolted into action by some unseen force, intuitively knowing what to do and taking leadership of the situation. Jack turned to Agent Ellis Carter.
I want to see the surveillance tapes of the station. Can you get hold of those?
I don't know what's left of them, if anything survived the blast, Jack.
Well, find out then, Jack responded firmly. I want the tapes at Langley. Maybe we'll get lucky and find our bomber is on one of them. Let me know as soon as you have them. I'm going to find this son of a bitch.
Sounds like you have a plan, Jack.
Why doesn't that surprise me?
And with that, Agent Carter disappeared off into the crowd, one arm clutched around a walkie-talkie, the other directing his team into action to begin the hunt for the unknown bomber. As the agents slipped off into the chaos, each with their own tasks and objectives, Jack made his way out of the station. Emergency crews and police still swarmed around the area, darting about frantically, trying to take control of a situation that was completely beyond their reach, trying to regain the power that had been so brutally robbed by an unknown assailant. Among all the pandemonium and confusion, though, Jack made his way from the scene. He was planning his next step, and already working out how to discover who had committed, and more importantly, why they had committed this act of barbarism upon his country.